And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy 4th of July to you and yours. On today's morning show, I am replaying a conversation that I recorded back in 2014 with Dr. Mark Clegg, professor of musicology and American culture at the University of Michigan. Professor Clegg is arguably our country's leading authority on the Star-Spangled Banner. And as a matter of fact, Professor Clegg was instrumental in creating an amazing project known as Poets and Patriots. It is a extensive recorded history of the Star-Spangled Banner in its earliest iterations and in the many variations that have occurred over the generations. And these recordings can still be accessed at the website starspangledmusic.org. Towards the end of today's morning show, you're going to hear an interesting and inspiring sampling of various performances of our national anthem. But first, a portion of my conversation with Professor Clegg recorded back in 2014. By the way, Professor Clegg is also the author of a fascinating book called O Say Can You Hear? A Cultural Biography of the Star-Spangled Banner, published by W.W. Norton. At what point did you begin to really focus so specifically, although I don't mean to imply to the exclusion of all other musicological matters, but obviously the grand focus of your work is in America's own musical history. Did anything in particular serve as a catalyst for that, for you to want to delve into our own musical history with such passion and with such depth?
Yeah, it's a very specific thing, actually. It's the headline of the Chicago Tribune on December 10th, 1889.
you wear your age very well, Professor Clegg.
Thank you very much. Yes, it was that moment I opened, you got my cup of joe and opened the paper. And it says in bold letters, dedicated to music and the people. And it is a reference to the Auditorium Theater in downtown Chicago. And when I was a grad student at the University of Chicago, I was taking a social history of music class with a professor named Hans Lenneberg. He was a librarian. And we were looking at, you know, topics in social history. And so I turned to American studies in part because I wanted a very rich archival resource to work with. So something, you know, in local history. And so the big question was, here's this giant opera house being dedicated in downtown Chicago in the sort of Gilded Age, and it's dedicated to music and the people. And so what music and which people was the question I started with. And that's really what got me into looking at music in American life in a deep way. Before that, I had been very much interested in Baroque music. As I said, I sort of started off thinking I would be a Telemann scholar. And shifted rather radically at that moment to going into American studies. And the thing that's been so much fun for me about American music, it's a relatively new field. I mean, it's pretty mature by now, but it's in some ways we could probably date the beginning of at least the broader academic engagement with music of the United States to the American Bicentennial. In 1976, which is really for me is sort of one of my earliest childhood memories. I was 10 years old at the time. And I very much remember being in the neighborhood parade with my bike outfitted in red, white, and blue streamers. And that's probably my fascination with the Star-Spangled Banner dates from that moment. But when I was in graduate school, starting to look seriously at American music was just becoming broadly accepted. Before that time, it was people who had studied European music and then, you know, to get their degree and their qualifications as a scholar, and then they were then moving into jazz and moving into American music in other ways. But they cut their teeth on Caccini or, you know, Wagner or Beethoven. By the time I was in school, which was in the 90s, it was accepted to do, you know, really to specialize in American music from the very beginning, and there were a few pioneering people. So although I love being one of the current experts on the Star-Spangled Banner, I'm certainly building my research on the part of many, many scholars, including a guy named Oscar Sonic, who was the very first head of the music division of the Library of Congress. And that's a lot of the scholarship about the Star-Spangled Banner in particular has come out of the Library of Congress, prompted by letters from everyday Americans, you know, asking their congressmen some question about the song, and that representative turning it over to the Library of Congress to say, please answer this. And so that resulted in really the first Brooke link study of the Star Spangled Banner by Oscar Sonic called The Star Spangled Banner. And it goes in over 100 pages just basically trying to figure out when this thing got printed and who might have written it. And in the end, they still didn't know.
Mm.
So what's sort of amazing to me about the Star Spangled Banner is that, you know, we're so comfortable with it. It's so much a part of our everyday life as Americans. Rituals of, you know, the Friday night high school football game and Saturday here at the big house in Ann Arbor with the University of Michigan. And, you know, it's ubiquitous. And yet we don't actually know that much about the song. What we really know about the song is it comes from the lyrics. So people imagine Francis Scott Key and, you know, in aboard a ship looking at the flag, and they can tell that story, but they're actually learning it not from any history or broader contextual understanding. They're learning it from the first verse itself, for the most part. And so that leads to a lot of mythologizing. We sort of, in our mind's imagination, sort of make up the part that makes the song make sense to us. And, you know, the sort of the historical work of really locating the song in a specific time and place has just really wasn't done because nobody thought it was needed.
Hmm. And I think one of the reasons I ended up seeking out this recording, Poets mm-hmm. and Peasants, and I'm sorry, Poets and Patriots, and writing a review of it was in part because of the fairly extensive discussion which was inspired earlier this year when opera star Renee Fleming was invited to sing the national anthem at the Super Bowl. And I think that sparked at least a few conversations about the national anthem that maybe hadn't taken place in a while, about exactly who is most appropriate to sing the national anthem and in what style should it be sung, and people bandying about their own opinions about that. But you start to realize that these conversations about the national anthem include almost no understanding about where it really came from. And so I was so delighted then to discover that there was a place where I could turn and other Americans could turn, anybody could turn, who was interested in having some very fundamental questions answered for the very first time.
Yeah, we put together a video of that first Thomas Carr arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner from, see, the late October, early November, 1814. Thomas Carr was the organist at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Baltimore, was a friend of Francis Scott Key, who was also Episcopal. And Carr's Music Store in Baltimore was the place where the first time we had a piece of sheet music that had the words of the Star Spangled Banner, you know, married to musical notation. Prior to that time, it was published entirely as a sheet of lyrics. And so one of the confusions I've been trying to correct is, you know, did Francis Scott Key write a poem that someone else set to music, or did he write a song intending these words as lyrics that would always be sung with a melody? And it's that latter conclusion that I and several other scholars have come to for a bunch of different reasons. One is this notion of writing new words to old tunes was very common in the late 18th and early 19th century. So we think of it today as maybe, you know, something we wouldn't even want to do, to write, you know, new words to the Star Spangled Banner melody. That's just, that would seem sort of, you know, a violation of this sacred hymn. But in Francis Scott Key's day, and even after he wrote the song, many, many people wrote different lyrics to that same melody. In some cases, it was connected to the original source tune, the Anacreontic Song, which is a musicians' club anthem from London, from around 1775, 76. And then in other cases, it was a direct response to Key's song, to making some commentary on what the nation should be and sort of trading upon the growing patriotic connections of Francis Scott Key's song of celebration. It's really a victory tune. So, you know, one of the things that surprises people is how fast the original tempo is. I mean, it's originally marked conspirito, with spirit. And it's a song of celebration. It's a victory tune after, you know, what for Key was a big surprise. I mean, almost nobody mentions in the history books that Francis Scott Key was present at the burning of Washington, D.C., which happened on the 24th of August of 1814. So he is actually in the Georgetown militia. He is head of an artillery company because he was an educated man. He was given an officer's position. And he was at the Battle of Bladensburg, really one of the most ignominious defeats in American history, where the British overran the American defenses in less than an hour and, you know, went unopposed into Washington, D.C. and burned all the federal buildings in the Capitol, starting with the U.S. Congress and burning, like, the Library of Congress had 3,000 volumes in it, was destroyed, and then going on to the White House and then the U.S. Treasury. So he had seen basically the prowess of the British troops who had, you know, had been fighting Napoleon in Europe. And then when Napoleon was defeated, basically the British was finally able to send their real army to America for the War of 1812. Prior to that time, we were sort of a comedy of errors between the U.S. troops and the Canadian troops. But when the real British army showed up, we were in some serious trouble. And so that right after D.C., the attack was, you know, sent to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And Francis Scott Key expected Baltimore to fall in a very similar way to Washington, D.C., I think. And so part of his response, I mean, understanding his emotional perspective on that victory is pretty special when you know that he was at this terrible defeat and then expecting the same and then seeing the heroism of Baltimore's defenders able to withstand a 25-hour artillery barrage where they were really sitting ducks. I mean, they couldn't fight back because Britain had better guns than we did. So the American guns could shoot, you know, basically the British ships could park out of range of Fort McHenry's guns and then just bomb continuously the fort, just hoping to blow up the powder magazine in the center of the fort, and miraculously they never did. And he really did see it as a miracle. I mean, when you get to that fourth verse, which we don't usually sing these days, where he is really sort of bringing his whole story to its conclusion, he says, "In God is our trust," right? He's talking about the heaven-rescued land. He really sees God as having switched sides, if you will, and from going from punishing the United States for its insolence in declaring war, which a war he opposed, actually. He was not in favor of the War of 1812, to seeing, you know, what he saw as the, you know, the shift from the overrunning of Washington, D.C. to the stalwart defense of Baltimore really, for him, showed that God had sort of changed sides and was the American nation would survive in part because of divine providence. And so it's an amazing song. It tells a powerful story, and I think that's one reason why we still remember it today.
I appreciated on your own Facebook page, I guess it would be a couple of days ago, you making mention of the fact of that anniversary. You said, I think your posting is 200 years ago today, Washington was burning.
Mm-hmm.
And something about those stark words on the screen was really pretty chilling. And I think you're right that it's important for us as much as we possibly can all these years later, two centuries later, to think about the kind of threat that our small new nation was facing. And that helps us explain the immensity of this victory, whatever it really meant in terms of the scope of the entire war, what it meant in that moment to someone like Francis Scott Key, who had seen his own capital burn. That's something most of us do not begin to appreciate like we should.
Yeah, for us today, I think war is a pretty distant phenomenon. You know, we're hearing about it constantly on the news. We may see pictures of suffering, but it's something that happens someplace else. And this is, you know, a time when our own capital was occupied by, you know, General Ross and General Cochrane, and you know, it's a pretty amazing moment where, you know, the sort of world we know today, which seems so much a part of Francis Scott Key's song, was still something in the future. It was a hope. It was an aspiration. And that I think is one of the other interesting things about the Star Spangled Banner, is that we see it now as a kind of statement of fact, but the first verse ends with a question mark. I mean, he says, you know, "Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave?" Question mark. We sing it now with a period or maybe even an exclamation mark.
Of course.
But for Francis Scott Key, it really was a question. Would this country continue? Would the sort of, you know, country that could rescue the world during World War II, that could become a superpower, would that country ever happen, or would it revert to British rule, which really was a possibility, at least at this time? I mean, the burning of Washington wasn't that important strategically, but it was hugely important symbolically. And if Britain could destroy our capital, I mean, the despair of the nation and the loss of that dream of the Declaration of Independence, really in the burning of our own capital building, the insult that that gave to our country, I mean, brought into question all of the hopes of our founding fathers. And, you know, Francis Scott Key was born in 1779, so he's one of the sort of first generation of Americans never to know colonial rule. For him, this was his world, and his world was going up in flames.
Right.
Literally.
It could have all winked out of existence. I mean, that was a very real possibility, and it probably felt like an even more likely possibility than perhaps it actually was. I suppose it's hard to say now, but for someone like Francis Scott Key, his new nation was on the precipice of extinction.
I think that's probably true. Yeah, it's an amazing moment. And so when he writes that lyric, he's setting forth a dream in a certain way of what he hopes the future will hold. And we sing it now as a statement of fact, but for Key it was a statement of hope.
I want to make sure our listeners understand that this marvelous recording, Poets and Patriots, includes not only the text that we know, but an array of fascinating variants on the national anthem. And without going into an enormous amount of detail, maybe you could just kind of sketch the scope of these variations that exist, that are today all but forgotten, but in a sense revived for us to examine and hear again in this recording project.
No, great idea. So this is all part of a tradition of, you know, sort of cultural discourse called the broadside ballad tradition, in which poets and lyricists wrote new lyrics to old tunes to reflect sort of significant happenings in their world. It's often talked about as a way in which news traveled, but I think it had less to do with reporting the facts than it had to do with communicating the emotional significance of an event. So I don't think anybody learned that Baltimore had been successfully defended from the Star-Spangled Banner. What I think they came to understand was the meaning, the emotional power of that happening, and the way it turned the tide of sort of emotion and the hope of the country. So, but this starts in England with a musicians club anthem called the Anacreontic Society. And so it's basically their meetings involved a two-hour symphony concert, a dinner, and then an evening of singing songs, sort of like an episode of Glee, but with only men, because women weren't part of the social life in London at the time. And they had a reputation for, you know, getting a little crazy. A little bit of wine was spilled in those late evening things, and most of the respectable members of the club would go home by midnight, but apparently sometimes they would stay till dawn singing songs. And but the club anthem itself is very much connected with the aspirations of the club as a social society, but also as a society for cultural betterment of its members. So they were singing songs to make the way we look at music education today as sort of making humans better humans. In any event, this tune becomes part of the sort of London theater scene because the club actually hires professionals to come in and sing for their meetings rather than singing them themselves. So part of the reason why it's so hard to sing the Star-Spangled Banner today, why we have people like Renee Fleming at the Super Bowl, is because the melody was intended for a professional or at least a very polished amateur to show off their skill. So singers can sound great doing this. The average person in a crowd at a football game or a high school graduation, maybe not so great. But the anonymity of the crowd, I think, protects us all. And my philosophy is we just sort of go for it and do the best we can, take a deep breath. And I think that's sort of part of the song. I think that's part of why Francis Scott Key chose that athletic melody. He wanted something that required a certain commitment. You know, most national anthems have just a very narrow melodic compass. You can almost sort of moan them into existence. You can't do that with the Star-Spangled Banner. You need to go for it, and I think that's part of the power of the song. But anyway, writing all of these lyrics becomes a way that, again, people made a comment about things happening in their world, and these lyrics would be published in newspapers with a little indication that would say, tune, colon, Anacreon. or tune colon Hearts of Oak or tune colon Yankee Doodle. And they people would write different lyrics talking about contemporary politics, certain momentous occasions. He himself had written a song called When the Warrior Returns in honor of America's first naval hero, Stephen Decatur, and that's one thing that's on the disc. And he wrote that in 1805, and it uses that same melody. When the warrior returns from the battle afar. So we know that when Key, 9 years later, is in Baltimore Harbor on the Patapsco River, he knows this melody because he had used it before. So he's going to his bag of tricks and using something that worked before for a patriotic occasion.
By the way, I want you to just say a word about the fact that it wasn't perhaps all that uncommon for an American poet to write words and that the melody originate in Britain or in Germany or in some other place, but that evidently there were certain Americans who did take umbrage at that, who did not want patriotic words about America sung to a British melody. You make mention of that in the liner notes and, in fact, give us one example, at mm-hmm. least, of one American composer who tried to write entirely different music for the words of Francis Scott Key, music which understandably faded into oblivion because it isn't, in my opinion, all that effective. But it speaks to the difference of opinion that for some people it was just a catchy melody and it's just fine if it's British, and for others that presented a problem.
Right. Well, the version you're talking about is by James Hewitt. It's from 1817, and was actually, as far as I can tell, pretty popular, particularly in and around New York, where Hewitt lives, in the 1820s. I mean, it went through many editions. It's before this point has been talked about as a kind of, confusing anomaly that it was just some sort of, strange variant that never took on. But I think it actually was fairly popular in its day, and I've come to like it, actually. I mean, in our recordings, one of the things we really did was try to bring out as much acoustic and musical variety as we could, with singing other songs like Hail Columbia, which was, probably the closest thing we had to a national anthem before the U.S. Civil War, anyway, and the sort of rising importance of Key's anthem. But you're right. I mean, we were culturally British. We were a former colony. We spoke English, so it's actually not all that surprising that our cultural resources are sort of the melodies that are in our cultural memory are also culturally British. So if you think of a tune like My Country, 'Tis the Sea, it's also the same melody as God Save the King or God Save the Queen. And it's, some people took umbrage to that, including Mr. Hewitt, but it was also something that was just very normal, so that just because there was so much cultural overlap between all of our heritages coming over from England. There certainly was a lot of immigration from other countries, but in some way that's post-dating it. That's coming into the 19th century is really where we have the huge immigrations of Irish, the huge immigrations of Germans after the 1848 revolution and its failure. And sort of, we shift as a country and we're always becoming this melting pot. But initially the pot is almost entirely British. So our music is almost entirely British.
Right. Dr. Mark Clegg is professor of musicology and American culture at the University of Michigan. His book is O Say, Can You Hear? A Cultural Biography of the Star-Spangled Banner, published by W.W. Norton. And the project that he oversaw, Poets and Patriots, is still available. You can go to the website starspangledmusic.org. Now we're going to enjoy a interesting and inspiring array of various performances of our national anthem, beginning with a performance quite memorable back in 2014. The occasion was a special concert that celebrated the 200th anniversary of the national anthem, in which John Williams conducted the National Symphony Orchestra, the U.S. Army Herald Trumpets, and the Joint Armed Forces Chorus and Choral Arts Society of Washington, performing a new arrangement created for the occasion by John Williams himself, one of our finest living composers.
Thank you. Thank you. Tonight we celebrate the 200th anniversary of our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. And the history of the song's creation is in itself an inspiring story. In September 1814, U.S. soldiers at Fort McHenry in Baltimore, after a 25-hour-long battle, raised a huge American flag to mark a critical victory in our nation's ongoing struggle for independence. As the smoke cleared that morning, the image of those broad stripes and bright stars inspired the young poet Francis Scott Key to compose the words for what would become our national anthem. And so tonight, as we celebrate the 200th birthday of the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key's historic words resonate still and remind us that through the power of music, this proud old tune continues to unite us all.
An arrangement by John Williams to honor the 200th anniversary of the writing of our Star-Spangled Banner. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next, we hear a performance of our national anthem. that took place at the 2023 College Football National Championships, a performance rendered by the Grammy Award-winning group Pentatonix. Grammy Award-winning group Pentatonix at the 2023 College Football National Championships. From that spectacularly rhapsodic performance by Pentatonix, we turn to a performance of the Star-Spangled Banner that at least begins in surprisingly reticent, understated fashion. Surprising because the singer at hand is an opera singer, the wonderful American baritone Lucas Meacham. And we don't often think of the genre of opera or opera singers as understated. But there actually is a beautiful sense of restraint and reticence at the outset of this performance, which Lucas Meacham delivered at Madison Square Garden before a Rangers-Penguins game.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. And the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free? The home of the brave.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lucas Meacham.
Here is another performance of the Star-Spangled Banner, which, like that of Lucas Meacham, begins with dignified restraint, before becoming quite spectacular in its own right. This is actually a transcription for solo piano by Leopold Godowsky. This is something that has been played by pianists through the generations, including the legendary Vladimir Horowitz, playing it at the White House. We will be hearing it from a studio recording on a Marco Polo compact disc, and the pianist is Konstantin Scherbakov in this transcription for solo piano of the Star-Spangled Banner. Next is the performance of our Star-Spangled Banner, which occurred on February 12, 2023 at Super Bowl 57 at State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, by Chris Stapleton. Chris Stapleton before Super Bowl 57. Our next rendition of the national anthem will be delivered by one of the most decorated classical musicians of the 20th century into the 21st century, the beloved and renowned violinist Itzhak Perlman. This was before a National League wildcard game at City Park in New York City. Next is one of the finest singers on the Broadway stage, Tony Award-winning soprano Kelly O'Hara. The occasion of this particular performance of our national anthem was before a game by her beloved New York Yankees.
Oh, say can you see what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so
soprano Kelly O'Hara. Now we hear the Star-Spangled Banner spectacularly rendered on pipe organ by organist Paul Fay. The occasion was a concert at Methuen Memorial Music Hall. And Paul Fay precedes the national anthem with his March Jubilant.
Thank you.
organist Paul Fay. We finish out this survey of noteworthy performances of our national anthem with one that, in a sense, takes us to the beginning, a performance done where Francis Scott Key first penned those memorable words. A performance at Fort McHenry by the U.S. Army Field Band on Defenders Day. An arrangement by Master Sergeant Adrian Hernandez, the national anthem performed at Fort McHenry for Defenders Day. I'm Gregory Berg, wishing you and yours a happy and safe 4th of July. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.